From the Moon Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. President Trump's former personal attorney's been sentenced to 3 years in prison. Michael Cohen told the judge he felt a blind loyalty to Trump, which made him feel a duty to cover up what he called the president's dirty deeds. The judge said Cohen deserved harsh punishment for tax evasion, lying to Congress, and violating campaign finance laws. The latest after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you're having a good day. Such pleasure to have you with us wherever you're listening in Southern California or worldwide on the KPCC app or at kpcc.org. Right now, Britain's Conservative Party lawmakers starting to vote on whether they have confidence in the leadership of Prime Minister Theresa May. Even if she gets enough votes to stay, tepid support might indicate her Brexit plan is doomed. We'll have the latest in just a few minutes. But first, as you just heard, President Trump's former personal attorney, Michael Cohen, has been sentenced to 3 years in prison. He'd pled guilty to tax evasion, lying to Congress, and violating campaign finance laws with payments to two women claiming Trump had affairs with them. With us on the very latest developments and the exchange with the federal judge, Los Angeles Times, D.C.-based reporter Chris McGarrian. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
Encapsulate some of the exchange between the federal judge in this case and Michael Cohen's attorney and what Cohen himself said. What were some of the most interesting things?
Sure. Well, Michael Cohen basically said that Donald Trump led him down a dark path, that, you know, he may take responsibility for his crimes, but that it was this blind loyalty to a businessman he admired that, you know, started this whole saga for him. And he apologized to the American people because of the hush money payments that deprived them of information during the election. And he basically asked for mercy from the judge. The judge did not sentence Michael Cohen as harshly as prosecutors wanted. Prosecutors described Michael Cohen as a greedy, ambitious man who didn't fully cooperate with law enforcement. But it was still a pretty tough sentence for him.
Now, and President Trump had actually urged the judge to give a harsh sentence, hadn't he?
Right. He did. Basically, Donald Trump has been accusing Michael Cohen of being a liar through his cooperation with prosecutors. It's totally unclear what Donald Trump thinks Michael Cohen is lying about. He has not been specific about that. And the answer to that question could pose legal jeopardy to the president. But he urged the judge to give him a harsher sentence.
And President Trump himself admitted the payments to the women, didn't he? Because I recall in a television interview he'd said that he himself had paid the money, that it had not come from a campaign committee.
So Donald Trump first denied knowing anything about the payments to the woman. He later admitted to repaying Michael Cohen for the money, since some of the money came out of Michael Cohen's own pocket. But it remains to be seen how much more responsibility the president takes for this, as far as whether he actually directed the payments, as prosecutors have said.
Okay, so that's still to be determined, because the president had said he just reimbursed Cohen.
That's what he admitted to most specifically so far.
All right. And are the other charges here, the tax evasion, the lying to Congress, how much of this is confined to Cohen's own conduct? How much of this potentially reflects direction of the president?
So the tax evasion and bank fraud charges involve Cohen's personal business and his private finances. But the lying to Congress is potentially very significant, and that involves the Robert Mueller investigation into any ties between Trump and Russia. Specifically, Cohen admitted that he pursued a Russian real estate deal on Trump's behalf through the time that Trump became the Republican nominee, much longer than he previously admitted.
And what do we know about the degree of cooperation between Michael Cohen and the Mueller investigation?
So Michael Cohen has been very, very cooperative with the Mueller investigation, meeting with them multiple times. And Mueller's team said in a court filing that Cohen has provided them with very specific and very useful and valuable information for their investigation. It's unclear what that is, but it appears to be quite significant.
All right. Chris, anything else to add before I let you go? I'm sure you're real busy writing about this.
Well, right now we're kind of waiting to see what else Michael Cohen might know. You know, his lawyer, Lonnie Davis, says that he has more of a story to tell, and there could be other, you know, embarrassing facts that Donald Trump would rather keep out of the news that Cohen will want to share going forward.
And do you know if, I mean, Cohen, when he's serving his federal term, can he write about that? Could he do a book on his experiences while he's incarcerated?
I'm not exactly clear on the rules on that. Oftentimes there can be restrictions on making money, you know, after you've been
profiting from crimes. Yep, yeah,
exactly. But it remains to be, you know, this could you could definitely see other avenues where he could get the story out.
All right. Chris, as always, appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Chris McGarry and Los Angeles Times D.C. reporter, the very latest. Again, federal judge sentencing former Trump personal attorney Michael Cohen to 3 years in prison related to multiple charges, including lying to Congress, violating federal campaign finance laws, and tax evasion and bank fraud. Terror Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Well, Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, is facing a no-confidence vote among her members of the Conservative Party. They're just getting the voting underway. We expect to have the results of the secret ballot coming up in just a few hours. But with us to talk about the very latest developments is BBC Washington correspondent Gary O'Donoghue. Gary, thank you for joining us again.
Hey, Larry.
So explain to us just a little bit procedurally what's going on with the Conservative Party lawmaker vote.
So this is Theresa May's Conservative Party in Parliament, and those MPs, there are 316 of them. They managed to muster the number of votes to cause a no-confidence vote. They needed to get 15%, which is 48 people saying we want to have a vote on her leadership. And that threshold was reached last night. Now, that triggers a vote among her own party in Parliament to see if she has the confidence of her own party. And, of course, that's why she's Prime Minister, because she commands the confidence of her own party in Parliament and, indeed, a majority in Parliament. That vote is carrying on now. As you say, it's a secret ballot, and it goes on for 2 hours, and then they'll take an hour to count those numbers. And at about 9 p.m. in London, which will be about 4 p.m. D.C. time, 1 p.m. On the West Coast, we'll get a result. And if she gets a majority, which is 158 plus one, if she gets 159 votes, then she'll have seen off that challenge. But she'll be hoping for a lot more support than that among her 316 MPs, because she needs some kind of, you know, firm mandate to carry on. Otherwise, she might feel she has to stand down.
Well, I wonder if part of this is a de facto referendum on her negotiated Brexit plan. If let's say there are more than 100 Conservative members of Parliament who vote against having confidence in her, does that indicate that the Brexit plan's not going to pass?
It's not going to pass as it stands anyway. There's no majority in Parliament for her plan as it stands. She's been planning to try and go to various European capitals to get some concessions out of people. You remember she pulled that vote, that crucial vote the other day, because she knew she was going to lose. And there's a good deal of unhappiness inside her own party. If 100 plus of her own MPs vote against her tonight, even if she wins that vote, that'll be hugely, hugely damaging. And she's been talking to her MPs in the last few minutes before the vote took place. And she's giving them an assurance that she won't lead the party into the next general election, which will be due in 2022. Now, that may give them some reassurance. I think it's pretty unlikely she was going to do that anyway. But the question is how damaged she is tonight. if she's damaged enough, or even if she loses this vote, then there would have to be a whole process of choosing a new party leader and therefore a new prime minister. And she would be a sort of caretaker figure in that role until her party got itself a new leader. And that could take weeks and weeks and weeks, which, of course, the country doesn't have.
And just again to refresh on the parliamentary system, that selection would come from just the elected representatives of her party.
It's complicated, yeah. So what happens is you have to be a member of parliament to be prime minister. So a number of people would put themselves forward. Within the Conservative Party in parliament, they would, through a series of votes, whittle down the candidates to just two remaining candidates. Those two candidates would then get voted on by the wider party in the country, the membership, if you like, of the Conservative Party, which could string the process out for a really very long time. What happens, or what can happen in practice, and certainly what happened in 2016 when Theresa May became prime minister, was that all the other candidates eventually dropped out, so there was only one left, which meant there didn't have to be a wider vote in the country among party members. And that person, in her case, obviously automatically became prime minister.
Not to get too far ahead, because she may well survive this, but if she doesn't politically survive it, who are the leading members of the Conservative Party who would be primed to succeed her?
Well, the one you'll probably have heard of is Boris Johnson, who's a very sort of charismatic, rather very vocal person on the Brexit side of the argument. He was mayor of London for a long time. He's very swashbuckling, if you like. He was the face of the Brexit campaign in many ways. Had one or two run-ins at times with the president here as well about various things. He would be one person who would potentially become a leader. There are others, like our Home Secretary, who looks after internal affairs, Sajid Javid. He's a bus driver of a Pakistani father. He's one of the people that also could lead. And also Amber Rudd, who you won't have heard of again, who's been in and out of the cabinet a couple of times, who's also a leading sort of conservative politician. But a lot of these names won't be in any sense known to you here. But the irony, of course, of what we've got at the moment is Theresa May actually wanted to remain inside the EU. I think the Conservative Party would try and choose a leader, if this comes about, who'd actually voted to leave, to try and deliver that Brexit.
We're talking with BBC reporter Gary O'Donoghue. He's based in D.C. for the BBC, talking with him about the election going on right now, the no-confidence vote in the leadership of Theresa May, British Prime Minister, and of course, the leader of the Conservative Party there. She has a big meeting in Brussels tomorrow, right, where she's meeting with EU leaders. And so coming out of this, what kind of a mandate she's going to have is going to be critical.
It is. I mean, it cuts both ways in many ways, I think, this, because on the one hand, she goes to Europe pretty wounded from this process. They know that she's pretty weak. But on the other hand, Europe is bothered. The EU is bothered about the amount of time that Brexit is taking up. It's stopping it getting other business done internally, etc., etc. And it won't necessarily want this process to drag on any longer, or have to deal with a brand new leader. So it may be a way of them being able to give her something to bring back. The problem is they've been pretty clear that they're not prepared to reopen the deal that's already on the table in any substantive way. There may be some assurances, some warm words, some things she can bring back of that kind. But the thing that her opponents and her critics want her to bring back is a scrapping of what's called the Irish backstop, which is a complicated arrangement that would kick in to deal with the hard border in the island of Ireland if a deal couldn't be done. And that's simply not going to happen. The EU is absolutely determined that that arrangement remains part of the deal, and they will not back down on dropping that.
We're talking with the BBC's Gary O'Donoghue. Gary, the fact that Theresa May, you know, her identity was so tied to Brexit, and now you've got a deal that her administration's negotiated that her own party is not willing to embrace. Is the party looking at this as potentially, even if, let's say, a Boris Johnson or someone else who might, you know, take a harder approach, harder line on Brexit, that when it comes down to actually negotiating a deal, that they too might soften, might moderate the stand if in the prime minister's seat?
It's possible. I mean, the difficulty here is that, you know, there has to be some sort of compromise in order to do this deal. There's money involved. I mean, at the moment, Britain's agreed to pay £39 billion, that's $50-plus billion, to the EU as part of this divorce arrangement. There are elements that deal with people already living in the UK from the EU, and British people already living in the EU from the UK, etc., what their status be. There's a whole bunch of things that do actually need to be sorted out. And the difficulty with crashing out of the EU, which would happen on the 29th of March next year, that's the date, that's a firm date at the moment, without a deal, is that there would be absolute chaos. No one would know really what the rules were, on what basis, you know, trade was done. I mean, we assume that, you know, presenting a passport or that kind of thing would get you in and out of the countries of the EU, but there's no guarantee of any of these things. And the danger, I think, for business in terms of long lines at the border and trucks not being able to get through with supplies is a real one. And that's something that people are very, very concerned about. So no one really wants, or very few people really want, what's called a hard Brexit, a no-deal Brexit. Even the Brexiteers, and most of them, will say they want some sort of a arrangement, some sort of way of smoothing that process, and then to get on to the real business of negotiating a proper trading arrangement with the EU. Because actually all we're arguing at the moment, Larry, about is the divorce settlement. We're not arguing about, you know, access to the kids going forward.
I love that. Brexiteers sound so dashing. I just picture them, you know, ready to go with their swords.
All right.
Gary, thank you so much again for talking with us this momentous day in the UK. We appreciate it very much.
Great pleasure, Larry.
Thank you. Gary O'Donoghue, BBC Washington-based correspondent, joining us. And a reminder, coming up at 1, right after Fresh Air, it's BBC NewsHour, a special broadcast from Westminster. And you'll hear the results of that vote on the political fate of British Prime Minister Theresa May. That's at 1 o'clock, BBC NewsHour, live right here on 89.3 KPECC. Much more conversation to come as we keep you up to date. The very biggest stories of the day. It's Air Talk, back in a minute. Yesterday, the L.A. County Board of Supervisors voted 4-1 to approve the massive Tejon Ranch development known as Centennial. Coming up in our next hour, we'll talk about the planned construction of that city right there in the middle of the Tejon Ranch historic property along the Grapevine Interstate 5. That's coming up in our second hour. But for the rest of this hour, public transit is our beat. We're pleased to be joined for his regular visit, the CEO of LA Metro, Phil Washington. Phil, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Larry, for having me.
We got a lot of big stuff to talk about. First of all, the proposed gondola to Dodger Stadium is moving forward. I have to admit, I've been rather skeptical of how this project would return enough funding to make it cost effective. But your agency has approved this?
Yes, Metro. We've signed a letter of intent with the Aerial Rapid Transit Technologies LLC, or ART. It's an action that really formally begins the negotiation necessary to make a privately funded aerial gondola to Dodger Stadium a reality. We're very, very excited about it. It's all privately funded, and it's a great mobility project to take cars off the road on the way to Dodger Stadium.
$125 million is the estimated price tag of this, as you said, publicly funded, but privately funded. But I'm just trying to think of the numbers of people that would use this, how long it would take to pay off that investment in it.
Mm-hmm.
Your thoughts about the feasibility of this as a business deal?
Well, I think it would work. You know, what they talk about, and we're going to do exclusive negotiation with them, but they talk about between 3,000 and 5,000 people an hour. So this is very, very exciting to be able to do that. Now, of course, you know that we have a Dodger Express that goes from Union Station up to Dodger Stadium, which is another great service. But we're in the business of working with folks that provide mobility solutions, so we're happy about it.
And where is the departure point of the gondola to take people up to the stadium?
It will be right there at Union Station, right in the front of Union Station. And it will we're still working through where it will take off from. But there's a lot of things to be worked out, but it'll be right there at Union Station.
And the cost for someone to take a trip on the gondola, has that been determined?
That's not been determined yet. You know, we've been told that it will be less than the price of parking at Union Station or at Dodger Stadium. So we'll see how that plays out.
Gondolas typically move kind of slowly. What's the estimated time of the trip one way from Union Station to the stadium?
We're thinking, and we'll still have to talk to the company, but we're thinking in the neighborhood of 10 minutes or so, or probably less. So there's a lot to be worked out. It's exciting, and it'll be a scenic ride as well.
All right, so that's the plan for a Dodger Stadium gondola with Metro moving forward on that idea. Phil, I also want to talk about congestion pricing. This has been bandied about for probably at least 10 years in Los Angeles. Some metropolitan areas around the world have tried it. So when you drive into, say, the city center, you have to pay a fee during peak times to discourage car trips into highly congested areas. What is Metro proposing for possible congestion pricing in L.A.?
Well, what we have brought to our board, the L.A. Metro Board, for consideration is the idea of congestion pricing. And what we're talking about here, one is a way to reduce slash, I think, eradicate congestion. We have to do something about the congestion in the county, and it's going to get worse. And so we have presented to our board an idea of congestion pricing. There's three primary models for congestion pricing. One is a quadrant model, which is a quadrant usually in the central business district of a city, and anyone that enters that quadrant is charged.
London tried this, as I recall.
It's the London model, and by the way, that model has reduced congestion by 40%. So it's pretty incredible. And then there's a vehicle miles traveled model that says that, you know, anyone that's driving would be assessed a fee based on if they go over a certain threshold with regard to vehicle miles traveled. So that's another model. And then the third model that we presented to our board is the corridor model that says that anyone in a particular corridor will be charged in that corridor, like the 110 or the 5 or something like that. Now, with any of these models, I believe that you must have a viable alternative. And that viable alternative could very well and should be transit. And so what we have presented to our board last week is the idea of congestion pricing. And we think if structured well, it can reduce congestion. We've also presented to our board, along with congestion pricing, the idea of free transit. Free transit all over L.A. County, paid for through congestion pricing. If we were to implement something like this, we would be the first major city in the world that would offer free transit on the scale that we have here in Los Angeles.
What about the potential legal challenge of roads and freeways that are already paid for with taxpayer dollars, then turning around and charging people for the use of that, almost certainly there'll be lawsuits that would challenge that. What does Metro Council say about that?
Well, we're talking to our council right now. They have not really opined just yet on this. But, you know, it would be irresponsible, I think, for us to not be thinking about ways to reduce and get rid of congestion. We've got environmental issues. We're trying to reduce our carbon footprint. There's more people coming to this county, another 2.5 million people in the next 10 years. This is going to get worse. And it all depends on how we want to live. If we want to take an hour to drive 8 miles or 10 miles every single day, this is a quality of life issue. And it's our responsibility to try to attack it and bring some things forward to resolve it.
I mean, one of the challenges in this is the potentially regressive nature of it, because I don't know what studies show, but it seems when we've seen the increase in the number of cars on the road and the decrease in public transit ridership, it's likely that these are lower income individuals with a comparatively low price now of used cars and gas being comparatively low, who are now purchasing vehicles going on the road. If now those individuals are going to be paying a congestion tax that maybe higher income households could afford to pay, but maybe lower income people couldn't, there's the potential impact hitting that sector much more harshly.
Well, there's ways that we can structure this. Even right now, we have discount fares, we have low income fares. When you talk about congestion pricing, there's ways that you can structure this so people are not harmed, if you will. Low income people are not harmed. So there's ways that we can structure that. We do it right now in terms of fares. But let me be clear. What we're talking about really is reimagining Los Angeles. We're talking about remaking. We're talking about getting rid of congestion in one of the largest cities in the world. So we're talking about doing something, rethinking, relooking at the city. And providing and giving our city and our county a different reputation with regards to all over the world. People think congestion when they think Los Angeles. And so what we have put in front of our board for consideration is a way to change that dynamic, to change that reputation around the world, and even in time for the 2028 Olympics.
Wow. And are you proposing specific routes right now that this would apply to?
We will come back to our board in January and in February, and we will be talking about a plan. We will be talking about pilot areas, route pilot areas. And so we're not talking about so much about city streets and things like that, but we will come back with those routes.
Would that require every driver to have a transponder in the car then so that they would be charged?
We are studying the technology and what that looks like. But keep in mind that we already have a form of congestion pricing here in L.A. County now. It's called Express Lanes. And the Express Lanes are wildly popular right now, wildly popular. It really makes for a very fast, easy trip through the middle of town. So we are already on the cusp of that now. We're talking expanding that in order to reduce and even eradicate congestion and also reduce our carbon footprint.
Phil Washington, the CEO of LA Metro, with us on Air Talk. If you have questions for him about public transit, our lines are open. He joins us quarterly for these in-depth conversations. We're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722 or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Coming up, we're going to talk about the big renovation project for the Blue Line downtown Los Angeles to Long Beach. It was the first of our big light rail projects, and it's time for a revamp. We're going to hear about how extensive and how long that's going to last. Also, Metro looking looking at e-scooters as a way of solving that last mile problem. Of course, they have their bicycle partnerships in different communities. We'll talk about where it stands on potential e-scooters. Also, federal funds that Metro has been getting for Purple Line extension and for other transit projects in Los Angeles County. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. And we'll be asking some of your questions as we continue as well. Once again, a reminder, BBC NewsHour special edition, 1 o'clock this afternoon, live from Westminster. The secret vote, Conservative Party members of Parliament determine whether Theresa May stays or goes as Prime Minister. Back after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdies. It's Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. Larry Mantle with the CEO of LA Metro, Metropolitan Transportation Authority, Bill Washington, with us. He joins us quarterly to answer your questions about public transit. And you know, since he's been coming on the program, it just seems like every quarter we have more and more things to talk about. So many different projects that are in the works. Phil, let's talk about the Blue Line renovation. That starts pretty early in the new year, right?
It does. The Blue Line that runs, as you mentioned, Larry, from Union Station down to Long Beach, this is the longest or the oldest line, rail line in our system. It's about 25 years old, and it's in need of improvement and rehabilitation. So we are about the business right now, starting in January, of doing what we call the New Blue. And this is a $350 million improvement project to enhance the safety, increase reliability, improve the customer experience. The project is going to start on January 26, 2019. It will be closed down in two segments for the needed work. The first segment will close from Long Beach to Rosa Parks Station. That will last for about 4 months. And then the second segment will begin in late May 2019 from 103rd Street Station to the Metro Center Station. This entire improvement project will be completed in September 2019. We're trying to get it done even before that. And we're going to be offering Blue Line riders a free bus shuttle during that closure, as well as special express bus shuttles to downtown. So we're redoing this line, new train cars on this line as well, and we're very, very excited about the project.
Now, with the express buses that you're offering, are they going to get stuck in traffic like cars, or is there some way of having designated busways for those so you don't lose time?
We're looking at how fast and whether we can do some dedicated bus lanes. And we'll come back and report on that as we move forward. With
okay.
The
yeah, you don't have much time because if you're right. Starting at January 26, we're just over a month away.
That's right.
All right. So the Blue Line with its renovation, are you looking at any other lines that have to have work like that done, or is just the Blue because it's so old?
It's just the Blue because it's so old right now. The other lines, we're doing a very, very good job of keeping up.
And when is the downtown connector scheduled to be operational?
The downtown connector, we're about 50% complete with that now. So we have about two and a half more years on that. But that project is going very, very well. It will connect all of the lines and really allow for a ride all the way from, say, Azusa all the way down to Long Beach.
Kimberly in Culver City said about congestion pricing. Seems to me people who travel longer distances to come into the city are those who can't afford the housing in the city. I don't know how charging people to drive to the city who are priced out is beneficial. That's Kimberly in Culver City. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Early warning system for earthquakes has gone into operation for different transit agencies, firehouses in California. What's going to happen with the shake alert system with LA Metro subways? Are the cars going to come to a halt, or what happens with the early warning?
Well, this shake alert, as you mentioned, it's an earthquake early warning system that detects significant earthquakes very, very quickly, where alerts can reach many people before the shaking arrives. So we're currently testing the system on our rail system. We've installed and tested at our rail operations center for the last 3 months, and actually in 2016 as well. What normally happens is the rail car, we ask the train operators to stop the train at the station, avoid stopping on elevated structures or overpasses, avoid stopping at stations that have structures over the station or just adjacent to high-rise structures. Do not block grade or pedestrian crossings. And so we tell our operators that they're all trained to do that, to stop the train and avoid stopping on elevated structures.
And all the trains are going to get the early warning system?
That's correct.
Are they equipped for that now, or is this to come?
We are still testing some of the equipment for that right now. So some of it is ready to go, and some of it we're still testing.
All right, very good. What's the latest on the Crenshaw LAX Green Line operating plan and the developments for coordinating the lines?
We brought a recommendation to our board last week for an option that we thought was the best option. Our board decided to go in another direction with what we call an option three. And so we're going to test that option for 1 year to see how it works and then report back to our board on the results of the performance metrics on the particular option that they approved.
What is option three?
That option three allows for people that come up from Redondo Beach to not have to transfer if they're going back east towards Norwalk. So we will test that option. Typically, people have asked, well, why are we looking at a service plan so early before the Crenshaw line opens up? But typically, you want to start with your service plan 18 months to 2 years out before a line opens up, which is why we have to fabricate signs. We have to do a number of different things. And so that's why we've started that early. But
Is that to work the bugs out of it?
Work the bugs out. I mean, that project right now, the Crenshaw line project, is about 90% complete right now. We're doing some of the most intricate testing of that line, the electrical systems of the line right now. And so we've started that service plan, and we'll bring back to the board the results of the option they selected.
All right. Phil Washington, Metro CEO, with us on AirTalk, 866-893-KPECC, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Your opportunity to ask questions of Phil Washington, the CEO of LA Metro. What's going on with your study of potentially using e-scooters? I mean, they've become so popular now, and there's a backlash against. I wonder if, you know, you're in wait and see mode given everything up in the air with e-scooters.
Right. Well, a lot of cities are looking at this right now. I mean, you know, Metro is currently in the process of developing rules and regulations that would help in the administration of any future scooter sharing programs. We've had numerous industry workshops recently with, I think, seven different scooter sharing companies to gather input from them as to how to better administer the program. So we're looking at this. We want to regulate the usage on Metro-owned right-of-ways and in parking facilities. So our regulations, when we develop them, will allow them to park some of their scooters at our parking facilities or stations and possibly at some of our bike hub stations throughout the region. So we are on this. We know that they're out there and they may be coming. So we're developing regulations and policies.
What about in some way subsidizing the rides to serve the last mile, you know, challenge of public transit? Is this something that you'd look at where some sort of a fare add-on or built into the fare for people that they could use the scooters once they get to the station?
We are willing to look at that. We want to develop a program that includes that. But it's something that we would be willing to look at. We'll bring it to our board in the spring of 2019 for their consideration, some sort of tap integration, tap card integration or something like that. So we're willing to do that.
To make it more convenient. Mm-hmm. What about the conversion to electric buses? How far along are you in that process?
We have started that process. As you know, Larry, we, our board, directed us to move to electrify our entire fleet of over 2,000 buses by 2030. And so we are implementing that plan right now. We will start in the next 15 to 18 months with electrifying the fleet on the Orange Line. That's going to be very, very exciting. We're also on that. And just by the way, on the Orange Line, we are installing gates on that Orange Line that will reduce the running time by some 20%. And so that's exciting as well. So that's
already a popular route. It'll make it more popular.
It's very, very popular. It is a dedicated right of way, as you know, for bus rapid transit. And it's probably our busiest bus route in the system right now. So we're working through a lot of different things, and we're open to, of course, the private sector bringing us ideas to improve mobility as well.
All right. When the fleet converted over to natural gas and you moved off of the old diesel, how long do those buses you've got currently last? I know the diesels lasted forever. They seemed indestructible. How are the other ones you're using now?
The CNG, the compressed natural gas, usually still has a life of about 12 to 14 years or so. Now, you know, we do midlife rehabs. We have great mechanics that keep our buses running. We have a big sort of asset management program where we are really looking at the condition of our assets and not just looking at age. We went from a age-based asset management system to a condition-based asset management system. And when you go to a condition-based asset management system, that means you need boots on the ground to do the condition assessments. And so we are doing those assessments on all of our assets, and the buses are doing very well, but it's usually 12 to 14-year life.
We'll continue our conversation. L.A. Metro CEO Phil Washington, his regular quarterly visit with us on Air Talk. Got some listener questions for him as we continue. Back in just 1 minute. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC Public Transit. Our topic with the CEO of L.A. Metro, Phil Washington. Eduardo in Santa Monica asked, when the rapid buses started, they didn't have a specific schedule. They were fast and great. Over time, they've gained checkpoints, a schedule. They're no longer rapid. Why was the rapid idea abandoned? Phil Washington?
Yeah. Thank you for the question, Eduardo. We have not abandoned the rapid bus. You know, one of the things we have a study or initiative that we're working on that's called the Next Gen Bus Study. And this Next Gen Bus Study is looking at how we improve our entire bus system all over the county. And the big piece of that Next Gen Bus Study is speed. How can we increase speed all over the system? We're working with the various cities with regard to synchronization and prioritization with stoplights. And so we have not abandoned that. We're going to introduce our Next Gen Study, the results of our Next Gen Study to the board in a few months. And I think what you'll see is initiatives to speed up our system and to even speed up some of the routes that Eduardo was talking about.
Chuck in Temple City says, traffic signal synchronization. We hear it's going to be done every time there is an increase in taxes to pay for public transit. But is traffic synchronization of signals actually coming?
I believe it is. Now, this is a function of Metro working with the various cities and their traffic engineers. So it's not just Metro going out and just doing that. If it was up to me, I would make sure that buses and trains had priority all over this county. But it is coordination between the cities. We're doing that. We have a great relationship with most of the cities in the county and the city of Los Angeles we work with on a regular basis. We are talking about that right now, and that is part of this next-gen bus study that we are going to unveil in the coming months.
All right. Talk with Greg in Highland Park. Greg, I understand you drive a bus for Metro. Go right ahead, please.
Yeah, I drive a bus for Metro, and I wonder if there isn't some kind of alternative way to collect fares, like get people to use cards, let people come in all the doors. I know in San Francisco you can enter both front and back. You just have your tap card in the back. You can have your tap card in the front. And just quit taking money on the bus. It slows people up, slows the bus up dramatically. A lot of people don't pay anyway, or they underpay. And if you just had fare checkers to check the cards, I believe your fare income might go up.
The challenge, I would think, Greg, with that is, you know, if you're taking light rail, for example, at each of the stops, you have a way to charge your tap card or get a tap card. The problem is, if you're looking at bus stops, how would you accommodate the person who only has cash and no way to get a card? Phil?
Yeah. Well, first of all, we are implementing all-door boarding on a couple of our routes right now. Greg should probably check that out. And so that has been working very, very well. And we have checkers at the back door of the bus that's doing exactly what he's suggesting. We are piloting that right now, and it's working very, very well. We started that about 6 months ago or so. But the collection of fares, it's something that, along with congestion pricing, that we've proposed, and that is free transit. And so we look at, you know, the cost of collecting fares, the cost, the overhead cost.
And enforcing
all of those things, money collection, all of those things. That is the very thing that we're bringing back to the board for consideration to say, if we implement congestion pricing, we should then have free transit and then not just free transit, but expand transit options all over the county. More frequent buses every 90 seconds, every 2 minutes. This is what we're talking about.
What percentage of the overhead of Metro is currently covered by fares?
We have a fare box recovery rate, if you will, of about 17%. This fare box recovery rate is a product of our fares, our operating, and any number of things. But as we expand our system, that fare box recovery rate will go down because we have, larger operations.
Yeah, fixed costs associated with that.
That's exactly right. So we're looking at all these things, and we want to bring some ideas.
Our producer, Natalie Chudnovsky, just back from a vacation in Japan, and she said there you can actually load money onto your card on buses.
Yes.
Or do it online just with your phone. So that's a convenient way, too.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
All right. Nate in Eagle Rock, with what seems to be in almost every segment we do with you, concern, says safety on the blue line. I was a frequent rider for years, witnessed fights, harassment by people who appear to suffer from mental illness, vendors bothering passengers. I hope this is part of the improvements coming to the blue line. That's Nate.
That is Nate. Part of the improvements, not just to the blue line, but the whole system. We are starting what I call a surge with 340 plus police officers deployed over each 24-hour operating period. We have 400 private security firm employees. We have 189 Metro security officers and fare checkers. We also have 40 C3 teams to engage our homeless riders as well.
And you got, what, $100 million from the feds for the Purple Line construction?
$100 million. I'm looking for some more.
All right, very good, Phil. Thanks so much. We appreciate it. We have a lot we can just pick up on our next segment.
That's right.
So much yet to talk about. Joining us, Phil Washington, CEO of LA Metro. A lot more to come in the second hour of Air Talk momentarily. Very good day to you. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We appreciate your being with us so much. It just seems like every day more and more news for us to talk about. And we also try and get some lighter segments in today, though. There's just so much big news for us to take on a little bit later this hour. The Trump administration is looking to roll back Obama administration policies in the Clean Water Act and how it relates to seasonal streams and the like. We're going to talk about what the implications are for construction and general development projects a little bit later. And then to close out the hour, the ongoing controversy about a homeless housing facility in Venice, which a number of residents there have been vehemently fighting. Yesterday, the LA City Council voted unanimously to approve the construction of the housing facility. We're going to talk about what kind of a legal fight that may end up unleashing. But first, we begin with another matter related to housing. It's the Tejon Ranch Centennial Project. For two decades, this project has been on the boards, designed to build thousands of homes in this area off Interstate 5 in the Grapevine area. We've done numerous segments over the years on it on Air Talk, debating environmentalist concerns, people concerned about sprawl and what they believe will be long commutes associated with Centennial's development. But yesterday, huge development as the LA County Board of Supervisors voted 4-1 to approve Centennial. 19,000 homes be built over a period of years as part of the project. With us, VP of Corporate Communications for Tejon Ranch Company, the developer, Barry Zoeller. Barry, good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry. Glad to be here.
We've been talking about this for many years, and so you must be feeling quite celebratory today.
Well, it is. It was a great day yesterday. As you mentioned, we have been at this for more than two decades. I can't think of a project that has been more debated or more subject to very thorough public review than Centennial. And so we were very grateful that the Board of Supervisors yesterday, by that 4-1 vote, really connected with our mission, which is to develop housing to deal with California's housing crisis.
Wanted to ask you about, pending any lawsuits which delay things, but how long are you looking at to develop the full community of Centennial?
Well, the total build-out for Centennial is probably based upon the length of time of the development agreement that was reached with the county, and that is a 30-year agreement. So that is kind of the window of how long it will take from once construction begins to the final build-out of Centennial. So it's a long-range phased project. It won't happen overnight. It will happen over time.
Now, with other subdivisions, I'm thinking of, Irvine's development, for example. It seems like the construction often started closer to the highways. You'd have a school that would open to serve the immediate community and then sort of rolling construction more and more distant. Is that what you're looking at with Centennial?
Well, the phasing plan for Centennial will begin with having a school and having commercial facilities, grocery store, all the things that you would expect in the community, open and ready to go day one. The first phase of the development, one of the first villages, because just to remind your listeners, that Centennial will be built in a series of kind of individual villages that are all be interconnected to be a trail system. And the first villages will be to the east of the California Aqueduct, which bisects the Centennial planning area, and then relatively close to Highway 138, providing easy access, and then just build and develop from there.
Okay. And when are the models, you know, going to be available for people to see and people contemplating buying in Centennial? How long are we talking about before that happens?
It'll still be several years. I can't put a specific time frame on that. A lot depends upon the actions by others and whether there is litigation involving Centennial. Suffice it to say, we will move as quickly as we can, given the regulatory environment and the litigious nature of real estate development in California, because there is an immediate need for housing, and we hope to address that need as quickly as possible.
Barry Zoeller with us, Vice President Corporate Communications for Tejon Ranch Company, which is developing the Centennial Project approved yesterday by the L.A. County Board of Supervisors. But speaking about the potential for lawsuits to keep the project from being developed immediately, with us from the Center for Biological Diversity, staff attorney J.P. Rose. J.P., good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me on, Larry.
So is your organization, or to your knowledge, other environmental groups looking at filing suit to try and stop this?
Yes, we are still weighing our legal options, but at this time it is very likely that the center will bring a lawsuit against the Centennial Project. You see, the California Environmental Quality Act prohibits the county from approving projects like Centennial unless the county can demonstrate that the public benefits of the project outweigh its costs. Here, it's clear that Centennial is a shockingly wasteful way to address the housing shortage because of its incredible cost on people and wildlife. And just as an example of that, we can talk about the fire risks and fire dangers. It is not if Centennial burns, but when. In fact, there have been 31 fires larger than 100 acres within 5 miles of the site since 1964. Building code simply won't save these homes. In the Thomas Fire last year, modern homes, which were built to current standards, still burned to the ground. And then we had Cal Fire's retiring director, the state's top firefighter, saying just yesterday that we need to stop building in areas we know are going to burn. Here, we're going to have county residents on the hook for millions of dollars in firefighting costs to defend Centennial when wildfires do occur.
Now, I could have misunderstood this, but I thought in Centennial what they were planning for the construction was going to be beyond what you're referring to as the modern standards of the homes that burned in these most recent fires. Weren't they going to go even beyond that?
I believe they were going to have some level of setbacks, but what we've seen in the recent fires in Southern California is even if you have setbacks of maybe 50 or 100 feet, that doesn't necessarily protect against embers getting into homes. Here, like I mentioned, we have the state's top firefighter saying we have to rethink the system of continuously building in the urban-wild interface. Unfortunately, the county supervisors decided to proceed with business as usual and approve this short-sighted and dangerous development.
Where would you get the number of units that you would get with a project like this by doing it in a non-fire interface area? I mean, so much of California that isn't yet developed is in this interface. Is that really possible?
Well, Larry, it's true that we have a housing shortage in the LA metro area. But the problem, the question is, where do we build the houses? We should build the houses near existing job centers. We have people commuting into the LA Metro from places like Lancaster and Riverside because there aren't enough affordable homes within existing communities and near those communities. I think Supervisor Kuehl hit the nail on the head yesterday when she suggested it was pie in the sky to think that Centennial will be a self-sustaining community. We know this because Santa Clarita, for example, 75% of residents commute outside the city to work. So what we should be doing is focusing new homes in existing communities or near existing communities.
We're talking with J.P. Rose, the Center for Biological Diversity, Barry Zoeller of Tejon Ranch. What about that figure, 75% of Santa Clarita residents commuting in? And that's a long-established city that has businesses that are there that's, put a lot into trying to develop its own homegrown businesses. So what would lead you to think that Tejon Ranch residents are not going to be similarly commuting in those kinds of numbers?
I think I would point to the study that was conducted by the Los Angeles Economic Development Corporation, which took a look at the opportunities within Centennial, took a look at the current business climate within LA County with a number of businesses that are moving out of the county. because land is too expensive and because housing is too expensive for their employees. And looking at the opportunities with the 10.1 million square feet of commercial industrial development available within Centennial, and they estimate that there will be 23,000 jobs that will be created there, not to mention the 25,000 construction jobs that will also be created. And mind you, that Centennial is planned to be a community of about 67,000 people, about 19,000 dwelling units or housing units. So that is more than one job per housing unit. Certainly, people will have choice, and they will seek employment, what is going to be best for them and best for their family. But certainly Centennial will provide the opportunity for them to be able to work close to home.
What about JP's?
If we could, just kind of big picture. A lot of the opponents and a lot of the arguments of the opponents, including the Center for Biological Diversity, have to do with the location of where Centennial will be built. We need to keep in mind that in 2015, LA County approved the Antelope Valley Area Plan, which designated the Centennial site as a place for future growth and development. And in fact, that plan would allow for a total of 23,447 housing units. Centennial's specific plan is for less than that,
okay.
19,000. So this is an area that has already been approved, already been designated, and already zoned for commercial and residential development because the county believes that this is a place appropriate and right to handle the housing shortage in Southern California and also to create jobs.
Barry, what about JP's point about even newer homes that were built to the most stringent standards required of new construction burned to the ground in these massive California wildfires over the past 2 years? So what would be different in Centennial?
Well, I don't have quite the same type of apocalyptic language that JP likes to use, but the example he gave of the Thomas Fire was not necessarily because of the building standards. It was because there was an electrical outage and the fire department couldn't get water. There is an abundance of water available for fire defense within Centennial, beginning with the California Aqueduct and then extending to Quail Lake. And part of the plan includes for ample water and hydrants throughout the community, for fire stations, etc. It also begins with even beyond current standards when it comes to fire protection. 200-foot buffers, restrictions on plants, making sure we're using fire-resistant materials, and at each level of development to make sure that the best practices are used in consultation with the Los Angeles County Fire Department and also CAL FIRE.
All right. Barry, what about the cost of these units? What sector of the market are you aiming at?
We want these to be price attainable units. We would call it kind of that missing middle market rate housing. So to give people in Southern California an example, we can't put a specific number on what the units will go for, but it's our expectation that it will be at a level of a discount below the Santa Clarita Valley.
Okay, less than Santa Clarita. And what's the approximate percentage of single-family detached homes versus condominiums and the like?
I don't have that right at my fingertips, Larry,
okay.
But it will be a mix, because we want people to have opportunity. We want there to be affordable homes and apartments. We want there to be starter homes. There will be homes for active adults for the 55-plus. There'll be a variety of housing, you know, to address those who have been priced out of Southern California, largely because there's a housing shortage.
Barry Zoeller is the VP of Corporate Communications to Owned Ranch Company, building the Centennial Project, approved yesterday by the LA County Board of Supervisors. J.P. Rose, staff attorney for the Center for Biological Diversity. J.P., before I let you go, is there precedent for a lawsuit prevailing using that standard that you described at the outset, which was essentially a cost benefit for a development like this?
Oh, definitely. In fact, Tejon Ranch has another project in southern Kern County called Grapevine that a court just ordered that the approvals be rescinded because the county failed to take a close look at the environmental effects. So we have already prevailed in that lawsuit. And just one more comment I'd like to add is, you know, this project has been around for about two decades. It was conceived a long time ago when we didn't fully realize the dangers of building in high fire areas and didn't fully understand the threat of climate change. But now we do. We have a chorus of experts warning us that we shouldn't be building in these high fire zones. And so for Supervisors Hahn, Solis, Ridley, Thomas, and Barger to approve this project, despite what we now know, is simply unconscionable.
All right. Want to thank you again. That's J.P. Rose, Center for Biological Diversity's staff attorney. You can share your comments about Centennial, 19,000 homes that are planned for construction, a community of more than 60,000 residents in Centennial once it's built out. That's the plan of the Tejon Ranch Company. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, we'll talk about the Trump administration's plan to roll back the Obama administration's plan for expanding the Clean Water Act to seasonal tributaries and the construction and projects around those waterways. It's Air Talk on KPCC. We'll be back in just 1 minute. Candidate Donald Trump called the Obama-era rule expanding application of the Clean Water Act one of the worst examples of federal regulation and said he would make its repeal and revision a priority of his administration. Well, Tuesday at the Environmental Protection Agency, it's proposed that the EPA changes the definition of waters of the United States, a change that was previously enacted by the Obama administration. The question is, what types of waterways fall under federal protection of the Clean Water Act? With us to talk about how the Trump proposal would change development projects and protections for waterways is Carrie Fisher, senior counsel for the California Farm Bureau Federation. She specializes in California water quality issues. Carrie, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So share with us from an agriculture perspective what the Obama administration rules, what the effect that had, and what rescinding them would have.
Sure. So under the 2015 WOTUS rule, it did expand and provide a definition for adjacent waters and also define the term neighboring. And it did so by adding in distance thresholds. So if you were within a certain distance to an ordinary high water mark, a water with an ordinary high water mark like 100 feet or 1,500 feet or 4,000 feet in certain cases as well, then all of that area would be a categorically jurisdictional waters of the U.S., which meant it was regulated under the Clean Water Act. And we actually spent the money to map out all of that area in California for our farmers and ranchers, and it would cover about 95% of the state of California.
Wow.
So that meant almost every single one of our farmers and ranchers would have categorically jurisdictional waters on their property. And that just adds in a whole bunch of issues in terms of what you're able to do on your property, when you're able to do it, the need for permits. They're very costly. They take at least about a two-year period of time, at least $100,000. So it just adds a lot of uncertainty on what you can do, when you can do it, in terms of just in ordinary farming practices and their maintenance of your land and just being able to continue being the good stewards of the land that they already are. It adds a lot of uncertainty and hindrances.
So is it fair to say that farmers in California have been big opponents of this and would be very happy to see EPA under the Trump administration reverse this?
Yes, we were and are big opponents of the 2015 WOTUS rule. And then I wouldn't categorize it as a reversal. I would categorize it as a totally separate rule that looks at actual statutory and case law authority and how the Clean Water Act was enacted in the first place and the bounds of that, and now creates a rule consistent with that. So it's a separate thing.
Okay. And to put it kind of simplistically, is it essentially that it uses a definition of waterway to mean a more major tributary than it did under the 2015 revision?
It does. So that was already in existence before the Obama administration's rule. So it uses a lot of that in terms of, you know, your traditional navigable waters. And then it does take case law that has happened over the last 20 years to specifically say what is a wetland and has it needs to be adjacent to certain waterways. And it tries to make it a lot more clear so that farmers and ranchers can see the rule, can look at their property and know, is the water in or is it out?
What about California regulation separately? Because, you know, California, very environmentally minded. Could there be state regulations that would end up superseding in this area?
Yes, there can be, and there currently are. And so that is one thing that, well, a couple of things for folks to know, that we already have the Safe Drinking Act, Water Act, the Safe Drinking Act. That's a federal act, and that's the act that regulates our drinking water and protects our water. So the Clean Water Act, even the version by Obama's administration, is separate from drinking water. So the drinking water protections are still there federally. They're still there state under state law. And so California does have its own water quality laws that are more restrictive than the Clean Water Act. And so farmers and ranchers are already regulated under that state law. And then in addition to that, the state is in the process of adopting its own definition of wetlands and the dredge and fill permit and process that goes along with any activities in wetlands areas.
To
come out real soon.
We're talking with Carrie Fisher, California Farm Bureau Federation. Also with us from the Natural Resources Defense Council, John Devine. John, thank you very much for being with us. What would you see as the effect, particularly in California, of the Trump administration's proposal?
Well, if they follow through with this proposal, it'll be the most severe weakening of clean water protections since the Clean Water Act was adopted in 1972. The proposal it's dangerous, it's unscientific, and it threatens people's right to clean water. In California, at least a third of the streams are rain dependent, which would get the axe under the Trump proposal. That's more than 200,000 miles, or nearly the distance to the moon. More than 7 million people in the state get drinking water from systems that pull their supply from rivers and streams, so making it easier to contaminate a big fraction of those streams means threatening many Californians' water supplies.
Does most of that seasonal runoff, does that go into the aquifers, or does that go into reservoirs that are used for drinking water? How is that distributed?
Many of these streams are simply tributaries to larger streams and rivers, and so taking them out of protection just means threatening the top part of the watershed.
All right. So if those protections are removed, then what would you see as the effect, particularly on the ag lands that are regulated more stringently now? What do you fear would happen?
Well, I would start with a big caveat, which is that agriculture is the least regulated sector of the of dischargers under the Clean Water Act. The agricultural producers enjoy exemptions from the Clean Water Act that most industries can only dream of. Many of their discharges, including runoff from rainfall or irrigation, are exempt from the permitting program of the Clean Water Act. Normal farming activities that fill in or discharge solid material are exempt from a separate permitting program. And then this, the Obama Clean Water Rule from 2015 exempted a handful of additional features on ag land from being considered protected waters.
What impact do you see this having on construction projects, development in California, if the proposal passes?
It will make it easier to fill in wetlands and small streams without having to go through the process of ensuring that those discharges are mitigated or minimized and in accordance with a review by the Army Corps of Engineers.
We're talking with the Director of Federal Water Policy for the NRDC, John Devine. Also with us is Peter Tatishi, who's the CEO of the Associated General Contractors of California. Peter, thank you for being with us today. What effect do you see this having on particularly major construction projects in California?
So our members are acutely aware that, you know, with whenever you continue to expand the regulation, that it creates uncertainty as to what kind of permits need to happen, you know, how we engage and comply with the law. Our members are always looking for compliance, but when the law is ever changing on them or the regulation is ever changing on them, it makes it very hard for that compliance to be consistently implemented and applied. It drives up costs of our job sites. It drives up costs of even entitling the land to a place where we can build on it. So with this new proposal that's out there, it gives a lot more certainty for our members as to whether or not the federal law applies to them and whether or not the permits that they need to be pulling or applying for are things they should be spending money on or spending a team of consultants on to get. The rule that was proposed or that was put into effect in 2015 included things that historically were not really meant to be, in our opinion, were not really meant to be covered, including ditches that we create and stormwater control features that are on job site specific. Those aren't navigable waters. Those are creations that we are creating in the process of building something and in an effort to mitigate the runoff. But if those waters become regulated under the Army Corps of Engineers through the rule, then it creates a whole new layer of bureaucracy that we have to work with and a new layer of costs that our members and the contractors have to manage.
But if those rules are rescinded and so some of those culverts and diversions are created by contractors on a property, what would provide, if that's ending up going up into the drinking supply, other tributaries, how is the public well-being assured without that sort of governmental review?
Well, as we have, the Clean Water Act always said that the priority was for the states to protect local waters. And so the state has very stringent rules and works with our members and with our contractors to ensure that our job sites are mitigating for stormwater controls and looking at how we have a runoff and how we even manage particulates in the air. So we have a lot of state laws here in California that ensure that our job sites are safe and are creating the right environment so that we're not polluting, if you will, tributaries and rivers in those spaces. So, you know, the state has every right and every authority to manage this process, which then allows our members in California to understand how to engage with the state. The problem is when the rules change on us in such a way that now we have another layer of government from the federal coming in and adding a different component to it. They are not always in conjunction or in coordination. And so this opportunity to be able to say we will work with the state, and that is our permitting entity, so we know how to manage those controls, that's a great process, and it's the right process that should have always been applicable, not reliant on the federal government to come in with uncertainty as to whether or not the waters that are created from a storm should be managed by the federal government or the state.
I want to thank you, CEO, Associated General Contractors of California, Peter Tatishi. Thank you for being with us. John Devine of the NRDC, Kerry Fisher of California Farm Bureau Federation. You can share your comments about this proposal from the U.S. Environment Environmental Protection Agency on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Like all of these proposed changes in application of rules, it's undergoing a period of public comment. Coming up on AirTalk, yesterday's unanimous vote by the LA City Council to develop homeless housing in Venice. That has some residents up in arms, threatening lawsuits. We'll talk about it right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Fresh Air with Terry Gross comes up in fewer than 20 minutes. Terry's guest today, Carrie Blakinger, who is a crime reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Carrie spent time behind bars on narcotics charges and has written extensively about life in prison. Her reporting has been linked to prison reform efforts in government. Carrie Blakinger with Terry Gross on Fresh Air coming up just about 20 minutes from now. But first, I'd like to hear from Venice residents what you think of yesterday's action by the L.A. City Council. 13-0 vote for a 154-bed homeless shelter on what had been a Metro bus yard at Sunset Avenue and Pacific in Venice. There's been a good deal of resident opposition in the Venice area to the construction of that homeless shelter. I'd like to hear from you if you're a Venice resident, whether you support or oppose the project. I'd like to hear what you think. We're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With me is Los Angeles Times reporter Dakota Smith, who was at yesterday's council meeting where the vote was taken. Dakota, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here.
This wasn't the only homeless shelter that was approved, right? Wasn't there one in South L.A. also?
Yes, there was one in South L.A., and these two follow one that opened in downtown. There's one that's up and running in downtown, which opened in September with about 50 beds. So these are going through the pipeline. They're getting approved by the city council. And like you said, you know, in Venice, there has been some opposition to this newest proposal.
And in South L.A., were there very many residents who showed up on either side for that shelter?
No, what we're seeing is that in some neighborhoods, these really cause an uproar. And your listeners might remember in Koreatown, people were also turned out against the proposed shelter there. So in some neighborhoods, they really are rising up and fighting them. And then in others, there's also one that was approved for Hollywood. They seem to go through pretty quickly, and it might be because they're not as close to homes. For instance, the one in downtown is basically in a business district. There aren't residents who live around there. So I think what we're seeing in most cases where people object to these is that they are worried either that it's going to hurt local businesses or just, you know, quality of life and perhaps what they would say is property values.
Again, we're at 866-893-KPECC, and I know that by no means are Venice residents unanimous in their view of this. I'd love to hear the mix of opinions, why you feel the way you do about the 154-bed homeless shelter getting approval yesterday from the L.A. City Council. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Paul, in Venice, your opinion of the action.
Well, I think it's a terrible idea. First of all, Mike Bonin is spending in excess of $5 million for a 153-person shelter that is going to be torn down in 3 years. So it's a colossal waste of money to begin with. There are far better, more appropriate, cost-effective sites the city has refused to consider. And in addition, for example, there are encampments in Venice with 25 people that the city cannot control. They're completely full of trash and drug use and stolen property and things. The police, the city services and everything, they're understaffed and they are unable to control it. Imagine 153 people allowed to drink and do drugs in an area 20 feet from the residents of Venice. No environmental impact study has been done. Bonin just sort of randomly picked this area And the amount of money he's wasting, because it's not a permanent step forward. This is, like, I'm repeating myself. It's a temporary
$5
million project.
All right, Paul, I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Dakota Smith, I mean, in terms of the siting of this, I assume it's because the industrial site was available.
Right, that this is a county-owned property, so it's something that the city can easily, you know, negotiate to use. And so I think that's my understanding is why they picked it, because it was available.
In terms of further review, is this close enough to the coast that the Coastal Commission has say?
Yes, the Coastal Commission does have to sign off on it, and it was my understanding that it was going to happen today.
Okay, but is that assumed to be pro forma, that they will support it?
I haven't heard any indication that they will not approve it, and I haven't heard any sort of city officials talk, voice any concerns that they wouldn't.
Now, Paul was saying this would only last for 3 years. Is that the plan, that this would just be a three-year-long shelter?
Right. So under Mayor Eric Garcetti's Bridge Home Program, what he envisions is that every council district, there's 15 council districts across the city, would get at least one shelter, and the shelters would operate for 3 years. And what the city is hoping is that, A, by putting these shelters in the neighborhoods, the people who live, the homeless people who have encampments in those neighborhoods will move into them. They cite, studies from homeless advocates who say that it's much easier to get help for homeless people if you actually come to them. So that's the hope. And what the mayor's office is hoping is that these people will then move into permanent housing. And so these beds will turn over. And I think that the mayor pitched the three-year plan in part just to get neighborhood buy-in, to say, look, this is the way that we're addressing the crisis. This is not going to be a permanent structure, and eventually these projects will come down. Now, I do think that there is some skepticism among some people that, what happens after 3 years? What if the homeless problem isn't solved? Are these shelters still going to go away? Now, the mayor may have moved on by then to another office or be termed out. So at this point, I think it's a bit of an open-ended question about what's going to happen long-term with L.A.'s homeless crisis and these shelters.
All right. Paul, I appreciate your call. Also with us from Venice is resident Scott. And, Scott, I understand you live just a few blocks from where the shelter will go.
That's correct, Larry. I live three blocks on Sunset Avenue, and I can't speak in more support of this. I'm a graduate of Venice High School, Go Gondoliers, class of 1998. And we have homeless people on our streets now, sleeping in our driveways. We can direct them there. What Paul was saying just doesn't make sense. An environmental impact study? This used to be a commercial bus yard. That was 10 times more environmentally dangerous than what we're talking about here. This gives beds and services to the people that need them most. Now, I understand the Snapchat crowd and everyone that's been moving into our community in the last 5 years might feel it icky, but this is a place where people can get the services they need, get back on their feet, and while we might not be the loudest voices at these events, we are definitely there, and our support is 100% behind this temporary
the shelter. This is Scott, and we should just mention that Snapchat has its corporate headquarters in Venice, and so you saying that the comparative newcomers might not be happy about this. But Scott, what about the concern that was expressed over drug and alcohol use and problems congregating around the shelter? Do you think that the city is going to be able to mitigate that? And, having centralized location like this deal with those problems?
This central location will be providing services that people want to get help, that want to get medical services, that want to get a place, a warm place to live, and a treatment facility for them to potentially hopefully get off of their addiction. We have people congregating three blocks away now. At least there will be a degree of supervision where there is none. And I can tell you one thing, this is at least an effort to solve the problem. I'd love to hear anybody else's ideas other than build it somewhere else. We have homeless people here.
Let's build something that can help them get on their feet.
Scott in Venice, appreciate your call. Thanks so much. We're at 866-893-KPECC, a chance for us to talk with Venice residents and stakeholders to get your response to yesterday's L.A. City Council vote, 13-0, to construct a 154-bed homeless shelter on a site of an old Metro bus yard at Sunset and Pacific in Venice. We're at 866-893-KPCC, and we're talking with LA Times reporter Dakota Smith, who has been on this story. We'll be back with her and your calls in 1 minute. We're talking about yesterday's L.A. City Council approval for construction of a shelter for those homeless residents of the Venice area, 154-bed shelter. Judy in Venice said, I live on a residential dead-end street, and there's a big homeless encampment near me. I think it's unfair Venice has to take on this burden. What about Hollywood? What about other communities? Well, as we just heard from Dakota Smith, L.A. Times reporter, Hollywood is going to have a shelter. The idea is to put these shelters in all different communities within the city of Los Angeles, so that each does its share, downtown Los Angeles, another one as well. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Dakota, I do wonder about the numbers we're talking about, though. I'm assuming there are many, many more homeless residents of Venice than 154. So did the city concurrently talk about how they're going to deal with those who could not be accommodated or would choose not to go into the shelter?
Well, I think that's a good question. With these 154 beds, what they're envisioning is that people will stay for 6 months or so and then move into permanent housing or maybe reconnect with their families and essentially move on. So if that works out, then potentially, you know, a lot more than 154 people could be helped as people cycle through these. But I do think that there's a good point that the people who oppose this, for instance, will say that not everyone in Venice wants help and people don't want to move into a shelter and they're happy with their RV near the beach. They don't want to have to move into a cot and share space with a stranger.
Well, especially if they have pets or things like that, where...
Yeah, well, although I do think that this Venice one is allowing pets.
Okay.
The one in downtown does allow pets, for instance, and I know that there, at least there's a pet relief area at this site, or a pet park. So, but I think the point is that, and even I think supporters of these will acknowledge that there's a contingent of people who live on the street who do not want to move in, and what the mayor's office has said is that these shelters are really for people who, you know, do want help, whose health is not in good shape and they need medical attention. Maybe they have serious mental problems. So the sort of the people who...
Much safer alternative.
Yeah, it's a safer alternative for those people who are living on the street. But I do think that the way it's going to play out is going to be interesting of who sort of stays on the street and who goes into these shelters. And until we sort of get a better picture of who's moving in, we won't know that.
Dakota Smith, LA Times reporter with us. Aubrey in Culver City, I understand you're a lifelong Venice resident. What do you think about the shelter?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with your previous caller that it's such an important thing to take care of those less fortunate than ourselves. I have a house down the street that was designed by some major architect that sold for $5.4 million. And, you know, just a few weeks ago in front of my door, I had a homeless encampment, you know, people that were dealing with substance abuse, with mental health issues, you know, with having been cast out by their families for being queer and LGBT. You know, people keep tenting up the prices in Venice with these, you know, incredibly luxurious houses. You know, the most fortunate in our society have a responsibility to take care of those who are going through issues and those who aren't fortunate to have access to resources like that. This isn't a new problem in Venice. I've seen this problem of homelessness and substance abuse my entire life growing up. And, you know, it's about time that we put this useless space that, you know, is just sitting there.
All right.
some really good use.
I appreciate it, Aubrey. Thank you for your call. James in Venice. James, your thoughts about the shelter. Do you support its construction?
Yes, I do. I'm a product of a shelter. And 30 years ago, I checked in a drastic meth addict, an alcoholic, and I went to a similar situation, went through school, became a counselor, worked in the corrections department, raised a family, and if I hadn't had that choice or that offer, I sure as heck wouldn't have made it to 60.
All right. And you're a Venice resident also.
Yes, last 3 years.
Where was the shelter that you lived in when you got yourself clean?
San Diego.
Okay.
I got clean in at the Volunteers of America, which is now part of the Petco Park because they tore it down. But then I went into a recovery center for 15 months, and in there I learned about going to school and I became a counselor and. Rest is history.
That's great. Congratulations, James, on the dramatic change in your life and what you've been able to accomplish. You have every reason to feel very proud about that and points out, you know, the best case scenario that people are hoping for with those who are able to take advantage of a shelter. Thank you so much. Griffin in Venice, what do you think of the council's action approving the shelter yesterday?
I think it's an excellent, excellent move on the part of the city. I'm really proud of that decision. I think that a lot of the long-term residents nearby are in great support of it. I mean, granted, that's split, but my family's fourth generation in Venice, and we're in great support of it.
And what about those who are concerned that there are going to be problems concentrated around the center and that's going to have an impact on family life in Venice and quality of life? Do you share any of those concerns?
I certainly do. I mean, I grew up with homeless in front of my house. I grew up taking graffiti off of my fence and et cetera. But the thing is if we disengage from the process and just say, no way, we don't want them here, that doesn't solve the problem. And if we engage the process, it's going to happen inevitably, as the council voted yesterday. And if we engage the process and try to be useful community members, then we can at least have a feedback system where, you know, everyone's views are considered and perhaps it's a more productive way to move through it.
Griffin, appreciate your call. Thank you so much. Great to hear the array of opinions from Venice residents and stakeholders. Marcos in Montebello said, I used to work in Venice. There was a homeless village I went through every day. For the residents of Venice who don't want this, just remember, Marcos says, this is already in your backyard, part of your everyday life. Homeless individuals need to be helped where they are. Joanne in Venice says, the opposite. Opposition to the shelters, very loud, well-organized, but they don't really represent the whole of Venice. Paul in Glendora says, why not, instead of concentrating huge numbers of homeless into small areas, spread them out more, have facilities, but having them places where they live in smaller facilities close to public transit or one or two people. Paul, the challenge, of course, in that is just finding those spaces, even for very small shelters. It's a tremendous challenge when you've got very dense areas like the community of Venice. Dakota Smith, LA Times reporter, has been closely covering the shelter process in Venice. Thanks so much for taking the time this morning. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Dakota Smith, you'll continue to read her coverage in the Los Angeles Times. And, of course, you'll hear our coverage of all the various facets and challenges of housing the unhoused here in Southern California on 89.3 KPCC. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. Have a great afternoon. And I'm back with you tomorrow. Getting ahead of myself.